I grew up in, South Armagh. I grew up in a village called Drumontee, but it was, sports, GAA, watching soccer, playing football with my friends. Some of the achievements that we did, we had together as a team. Watching my brothers certainly play. Now, my brothers and myself, we would have played county football for Armagh. So, watching my brothers win certainly trophies, win Ulster, win the All-Ireland in 2002. A lot of really good memories of that time, being with my parents. Growing up in that sort of era when it was, blessed to be a young kid. When you're past the GAA, you're a teenager and you're looking at your brothers and your family. We have a farm, small farm. Great memories of helping my father and my mother and, around the house, and being able to do that as well. Growing up is certainly some of the things that, when I look back now that I don't have access to here in Tramble. Certainly some harder days with, chasing cattle down the field that have broken out in the neighbor's farm. Maybe not good memories, but those type of things happen quite often.
Absolutely, mate. It's tough, tough work. I mean, it prepared you well for your last few months, I'm sure.
Yeah, definitely.
Class. So yeah, look, hello and welcome if you've just jumped in to Best of Belfast, the podcast that celebrates Northern Ireland and the incredible people in it. We've already been hearing today from Micheál O'Rourke, who is a psychotherapist from Newry, who moved out to Canada with his partner Leah in 2014 and has lived there ever since. So Micheál currently works for the University Health Network in Toronto, and he also serves on the leadership team there for their mental health programs, while also being heavily involved in the Irish Canadian Immigration Centre. Today's episode is part of an ongoing series we are doing in collaboration with NI Connections, where we're sharing stories of interesting and incredible Northern Irish people living and working overseas. And to see a full list of all the other episodes that we featured in the series, you can pop on over to niconnections.com, where you can also sign up for their free monthly newsletter featuring some of our exciting and interesting global diaspora community. So I love talking about the diaspora, because it's like the diaspora is sort of one of those things where you don't really know about it until you've become it yourself. So you go over to Canada and then you're like, oh my word, I'm now part of the diaspora. That's mad.
Yeah. You don't really it's something. Yeah. Like you say, when you move abroad, that's really when you only really sort of come to terms with it. I'm part of that community now. I immigrated to Canada and I'm now part of that diaspora. So yeah, it's only when you get here and you start to realize how far away you are from home at times that you're now one of those people.
So, I mean, cart before the horse, but take us back then to kind of the school days. What sort of stuff would you have been interested in as a teenager, inside and outside of school?
Obviously PE, sports. any young guy, growing up, playing sports, playing GAA, and watching soccer and, watching rugby, all those type of things. I was very excited when I went to the Abbey Grammar in Newry. Physical education was top of the list. And sort of as years went on, you start to, form other areas that you become interested in, and other things that I certainly, had an interest in was, I think, sort of geography was one of them. The world around us, and that's where it really sort of developed. And when you start to play sports and you start to have a sort of an eye on the mental preparation of sports too, and that's where the sort of psychology came in for me too, was when I went to Queen's. I always thought, a sports psychologist is what I really wanted to do, but working in that sort of specific field in Ireland can be quite limited, because there's amateur sports, there's some professional sports, but not as large as maybe sporting organizations that are maybe in England or sure. Abroad. So, but the mental preparation part of it for me, especially when I was playing as a young person and, into my adult years playing with Armagh and the county, that was hugely important, because I had that education behind me as well. And then I was also applying it when I was playing sports too.
So you kind of had the chance to guinea pig some of the theory?
Very much so, yeah. And that's the difficulty and the challenge, I think, with psychology is, the theory and the education that you receive, but how do you actually apply it to everyday life, for a lot of people? How do you translate that? And there's a lot of language there that's very confusing for a lot of people, but I think that's the good thing about the challenge for me, certainly, is, especially even today, I want to use language. I want to normalize mental health for a lot of people in a lot of ways. I want to take away maybe some of the terminology. That people might find, I would say, stigmatizing for them. Unfortunately, it carries it. It's taboo sometimes to even hear the word mental health, and it shouldn't be. But, you know, when you start to take away the theory and what you learn and apply it to everyday life, that's where I get a lot of sort of motivation.
So what sort of tools were you whacking under your tool belt then in terms of the mental side to sport? Like, what were you trying out that was like working for you and you were like, oh my goodness, this stuff's actually legit?
Yeah, and I would say, well, for me, really, look, at the huge part of the sort of sports psychology will be sort of your mental preparation for the big events, sort of big games. You know, how do you visualize? How do you control your anxiety? How do you control your environment? What do you need to do to put yourself in a position where you can control as many factors of a game, for example?
Yeah.
That's within your control, and accept, really, you know, there's other things that I can't control. I can't accept what the crowd will say to me. I can't accept to a large extent, you know, what my opposition player or the weather might do. So as long as you sort of prepare yourself in a way, in a mindset, in a frame where, you know, you understand what is controllable versus uncontrollable, some techniques and tools certainly allow you to prepare for that is really visualizing how something might fold out, you know, unfold, like the game itself.
Mm.
But then I think certainly for me, you know, as I developed and moved on, it's really understanding on a day-to-day basis as well how important that is for your preparation. You know, I'm not just talking about sports here, but what you do on an everyday basis will contribute to the long-term achievement of what you want to achieve. So we all have, you know, long-term goals, what we want to do, maybe with a career, sporting achievements. You know, a lot of that's not doable unless you have full control over your everyday actions. So really breaking it down for me, you know, goal setting wise was all of this. You know, you have these SMART principles that you learn about. but for me, it was never, the focus was never long-term. The focus was being better at what I could do sort of day to day, whether it was sleep, nutrition, it was, you know, practicing, going to the gym. And even today and now, like I said, you know, in the introduction, you know, my focus is very much when I put my 2 feet in the ground and grounding myself for that day, what do I need to get done today and achieve today? And that's sort of narrowing your focus into one area, you know, rather than trying to sort of think about the future and the potential outcomes, because that can create further worry and anxiety that you really don't have any control about, you know, something that's several weeks or 7 months down the line.
Yeah, man, absolutely. So when you were kind of visualizing that career in sports psychology, like, did you ever imagine going to Canada? Actually, let me go a different angle. When did you start reading adventure books?
I think I give a hint there. You know, I always had an interest in geography, that's for sure. You know, I always, like, I'd studied it for A level in the Abbey. I grew up in, you know, working around a farm. Those type of things were always sort of there, but you know, I read books about you guys climbing Mount Everest, other real sort of adventure explorers and across the globe. And then when you come to Canada, you realize how vast the country is, right?
Mm.
So it's absolutely massive. You know, landmass is the second in the world, so it's huge, east to west. It's so big, and you have so much exploring to do if you really want to do it. So when I came to Canada, really. You know, you come to a big city like Toronto, but it's almost like this tiny sort of part of Canada where huge population, but there's so much more to the country that's uninhabited because it's so large and so big. But I think as a human being, you have this sort of interest, you know, what's out there, you know, not just sort of like for career in Canada, but also other things that could be there as well. There's other cities, there's other places that you can visit. So I developed really an interest there, and when I came to Canada and trying to sort of see what else was within the sort of borders of Canada, and there's so much to do. There's really so much to do at the time. Now, obviously, COVID restricted a lot of that with travel and some plans maybe that we wanted to do. But it's just fascinating what's out there if you have that. And that's really where, I'd say since I moved to Canada over 7 years, a lot of that really took off for me.
Wow. And so, you know, if there was a couple of kind of little highlights of trips you've been on or things you've experienced or your own sort of, we hate to use the word adventures yourself, you know, because it's okay to call someone else an adventurer, say they go on adventures. It sounds weird to say it to yourself, but for yourself, you know, what are some of the things that stick out for you?
Yeah, I've been out west to the Rockies a few times now.
Nice.
And every time I go back out there, I find something new, you know, to do. And you come away from it and you think the next time I go there, I want to do that. I want to do something else. So a couple of highlights, certainly hiking in the wilderness and in the national parks. You have obviously Banff and Jasper, but there's other hidden gems out there. Like you've got Yoho National Park and Glacier National Park, and you've the Bugaboo Provincial Parks. You know, you've probably never heard of these, but you know, within them, it's real wilderness. And when you take off, you're taking off for a whole day of hiking. Some of the highlights, I would say, you know, hiking up the glaciers that are higher up, higher peaks, but along the way, coming across grizzly bears and bears. And only realize when you come across one of them, how big they are, you know, where your place actually is in the world when you're standing there. So
yeah, everyone thinks they're the big lad until they meet the grizzly, like.
For sure, like it was, you know, a comfortable distance, but you take no risks and you train yourself in advance and prepare about what you might need to do. And you know, there's a couple of other people in front of us as well, and we all just huddled together for 5-10 minutes until the bear had a bit of a sniff and then went away on its business down the other way of the mountain. So those type of things really stick with you. You know, you remember where it was and the time and location. So that's certainly one memory that sticks out.
Unbelievable. And so kind of like zooming out a bit then and speaking a bit more generally, why do you think that there is a rise in levels of anxiety and there is a rise in levels of depression, even kind of, you know, take the pandemic out of it? Yeah.
There's a number of reasons. I would say that as a sort of within healthcare, mental health is probably under-resourced. And, you know, maybe a lack of effective policy and services and investment and resources to give people the opportunity to access on a timely basis, I would say, you know, services that they need at the earliest opportunity to prevent something becoming chronic and further down the line where they will need actually intervention or treatment for their condition. So I would say that one of the reasons is a lack of effective policy maybe and investment in that area and giving people access to the resources. What I will say as well is, and you brought up the word society there, is, you know, mental health, we've come a long way, but we've still a long way to go in terms of how we talk about it and how we address mental health and how we speak about it and the language that we use. So society really promotes, especially, you know, among certain populations, that is, you know, taboo really to talk about it in ways. You know, emotions, you keep them hidden. You don't share your struggles as a human being.
Yeah.
It might be seen as a negative mark on you as a person. And people who are diagnosed with a mental illness, you know, have this unhelpful belief that you also have to carry the shame of having that diagnosis. So there's a lot of misconceptions out there that exist that make it a whole lot more difficult for people to get access to the treatment that they need at the earliest opportunity. And, you know, a lot of this is unnecessary. You know, some of the things are really tangible, like I said, the lack of maybe, you know, policy and investment, creating more resources. But a lot of this comes from society as well and how we need to sort of change and how we talk about it. And we can do that. We can do that as a community, really. We can do that as a society. We can create awareness about mental health problems more often. We can educate people better. We can educate people better and becoming more aware of the sort of the warning signs of deteriorating mental health and how to talk and have a conversation with somebody if you see it too. So there's a lot more that exists that are barriers, that are, you know, misconceptions about mental health, and we need to do better to really sort of improve that.
What's your personal connection to this space? And what I mean by that is, like, many of us have had jobs and have, you know, left them after 1 or 2 years because we just weren't really feeling it, or it wasn't for us, or, you know, we kind of lost interest in it. Why is it that you have stayed in this space? Like, what's kind of the passion that whenever you do get out of bed in the morning that kind of pushes you on day after day to keep going into this world? Because it's also an incredibly tough world to work in, which of course you know better than all of us listening.
Yeah, no, it is. Like, what I will say is, you know, I'd say it's through my sort of, say through my experience of playing sports, you know, keeping myself healthy, through my education, I've done health psychology, which is a really, really amazing field within psychology. So it really takes into the biopsychosocial determinants of your health. So when you think about that, you know, you take into consideration how important your job is to have a house, have access to a doctor, all of these type of things contribute to your well-being. So I'd say between sort of my experience of playing sports and my training and my education, and then coming to Canada, really, you know, I had a real passion for working with people who are most marginalized in our society. So this could include, immigrants, refugees, people who are homeless living on the street. And what really started to drive me was, you know, the empathy for a lot of these people, you know, and really wanting to give them the opportunity and the platform that other people have, that they never had the opportunity to improve their well-being. So I really, when I came to Canada as well, you know, I worked in the streets in Toronto. I, you know, some of my clients were people who, you know, addiction, alcohol issues, people who had overdoses because of the opioid crisis, but they also had underlying severe mental health problems that, you know, I also sort of concurrently worked with and supported them. So my passion really is driven, I'd say, every day, is provide access and care to people who don't have access to services that they need on a timely basis. Because I know what it was like when I came here as an immigrant, that one of the most important things is to get access to a doctor. And you know, healthcare is very important to people. But there's some barriers that do exist. There's wait times and there's, you know, fees that you have to pay. And it's really finding gaps within the system to try and narrow those gaps. And that's where, you know, I wake up. I don't say I wake up every day, but I wake up in this world. You know, I can certainly use that as a motivating factor to keep pushing me forward.
So tell us what your kind of day job looks like. What sort of things are you up to?
Day to day. So I work for full-time University Health Network, UHN. They have several hospital sites in Toronto, and I work at one of the locations, which is called Toronto Western. It's a very unique mental health program. It's a community mental health program where we provide outpatient community mental health services to our local catchment area. Our local catchment area is in Chinatown. It's got Portugal and Italy right on our doorstep. So again, the population that we serve is, you know, immigrant population group as well. And that's where I work on a day-to-day basis. My role has transitioned and changed over the last couple of months, certainly the last 6 months, where I was team lead of that program, of the community mental health program. So we've an amazing bunch of psychotherapists, social workers, psychologists. And my role is really sort of just providing leadership and team leadership on a day-to-day basis, but also providing, you know, direct clinical work to my own patients as well. So I carry my own caseload. And then I transitioned recently into a more leadership role where I'm supporting the accreditation process for our mental health programs across all of our sites. So working across different levels of governance within UHN, easier said than done at times. You know, the COVID pandemic has stalled a lot of these projects because naturally all your energy and focus has to go into this third wave. So it's all hands on deck right now. And until we sort of get through this, then it will ramp up a wee bit more about what I'm doing. And then I also have I have other roles. So I support the Irish Canadian Immigration Centre here in Toronto and across Canada. So it's a not-for-profit organization, an amazing not-for-profit organization that provides really three pillars and three areas of support to the immigrants that come to Canada. And those areas are, you know, employment related. So maybe sort of helping people get their resume or their CV together and where to start looking for jobs. The other pillar is the anything but immigration or visa issues. You can contact the center. You can talk to like Kathy Murphy, executive director, who's been at the forefront of supporting this organization for several years now. And then when I came, you know, first thing I done actually when I came to Toronto was I went to one of their webinars, one of their seminars.
Nice.
And that's where I really learned about the Irish Canadian Immigration Center. And then about a year or two later, Kathy Murphy had already started a mental health initiative through Monday social media posting about some of the concerns and issues going on. But, you know, I saw it and I said, listen, Kathy, if there's anything I can do to volunteer with. So I started volunteer with them, and then we started to develop the program a bit more. And we've now got like a third pillar, which is social care services. So I'm a national social care advisor, where really I support, along with another colleague who's in Vancouver, because we have a large Irish population who move out to Vancouver, with navigating health and social care systems across Canada. So when I talk about the health system in Canada, it's universal, it's free in a lot of ways, it's very similar to NHS back home, but it can become quite fragmented because of the province that you live in. So although money comes through centrally federal, it's distributed in different ways by the provincial governments. And there's different criteria and different sort of barriers that exist. And really coming here and learning about Toronto and Ontario and then other provinces as well we found the need where a lot of people don't know about some of the sort of barriers that exist, and our role has really developed in being able to provide outreach and support people in these areas. So that's the work I do with the Irish Canadian Immigration Centre as well. Evenings and weekends, I provide that when I get home from UHN, my job at the hospital. And I also have a recent volunteer role where I work as a subject matter expert for Immigration Refugee Canada funded initiative. It's called the National Newcomer Navigation Network, where we provide healthcare and social care system support to all immigrants and refugees. So I started to do that recently in a volunteer role as well.
So your plate is like way more than full. It's like if you're at a restaurant, you're like, can I have a side plate to manage some of the spillover as well, please? How do you personally like keep yourself healthy, and how do you keep yourself going? Particularly because, you know, we're all human and we've all had to deal with different stresses and anxieties, you know, that have come over the last kind of year or so. How have you managed to keep your feet on the ground through it all?
You know, I've had these structures and habits in place for a very long time now, you know, where I know if I keep doing them and I fall back onto them, then I'm going to be okay. These things include like exercising most days of the week. If I can get out and do it in the morning time or in the evening time, I'll do it. And those things, as long as those foundations are there and you have them to go to and you don't lose sight or direction of them and skip them, then they're a good indicator that you're still able to cope with the challenges and the adversity or the stress that you're going through as a person, because that's your outlet. That's your escape. So in a lot of ways as human beings, and just talking from a psychotherapy point of view here, you know, we hear a lot about sort of, for example, the fight or flight system that we have. It's constantly ramped on these days for a lot of people because of being on edge because of COVID, feeling over anxious and feeling very worried about these type of things. We don't really turn that off enough, and the way in which we tend to turn that off is through better care or self-care. You know, and self-care doesn't have to be, we've heard of self-care quite a lot, the concept, but self-care doesn't have to be, you know, soft and fluffy. It's not always taking a bubble bath. It's, you know, it's about addressing your immediate needs, whether they're physical or mental or emotional. So if they're physical, you eat at the times that you normally eat at. If it's physical, whether you want to go for a walk or go for a run. If it's mental, then it means, you know, talking to somebody, for example, you know, having those people in your life. So I'd say, you know, a lot of the sort of, you know, things that I brought on myself and what I'm doing right now, I'm able to cope with it as long as I keep those sort of keystone behaviors and keystone habits in place. I'm fine that way, and it works for me.
So those kind of keystone habits, then you're saying that you almost use them as an indicator for how you're doing. So if you, because I think what a lot of us find is whenever you start to get burnt out, by the time you realize it's probably too late. Do you know what I mean? It's like you're probably too far down the line. And so do you use like these keystone habits as almost like the wee indicator lights on your car, that if you start skipping some of them, you're like, oh, hold on a second. I probably need to take a look at this here.
Absolutely. And I'll give you an example. Like, we talk about stress quite a lot. And really, you know, our response to stress just represents a unit of energy, really, like the energy you have in a battery. You only have so much energy every day. Mm. So if you expend that energy constantly and constantly and constantly, you know, you're going to get zapped out. You're going to run out of energy. So it's really sort of thinking about it from the sense that if I only have so much energy to do this work, well, I need to leave energy over to eat, you know, to walk, to do the things that I have in place, then I know that I'm going to have the energy left over at the end of my work day to go and do that. So that's really, you know, the sort of the approach that I would take. And when your mood really starts to dictate how you think and look at things in life, and, you know, certainly with COVID, a lot of anxiety, a lot of people who have a lot of worry going on, it really can start to give you like this sort of bias and this, you know, way of looking at things that are really negative, you know, and you start to go in that sort of, you know, vicious cycle of negative thinking cycles. So I think it's important that when you start to have these behaviors in place and you notice that maybe you're starting to change, even if it's, you know, skipping a day here and there, it's fine within reason if you have an extra bit of work to do. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying every day you have to stick to it. But if you really start to, for an extended period of time, start to lose that structure and things really start to change in your sleep and your reading patterns, those are, and it becomes problematic for you, those are indicators that you're heading in a direction where you're your mental health is deteriorating. And, you know, I would record things. I'd have a diary. I'd look at how often I run. I use technology these days. Of course, you have a smartphone and a smartwatch that does a lot of that for me right now. So as human beings, sometimes we need that visualization. We need to actually see the tangible efforts that we have on a daily basis, because sometimes your mood, you don't give yourself the appreciation for what you actually do. It might be dictating otherwise. So a good way of doing that is having a good structure in place and being able to see it and record it, if it's a diary or in your phone. At least you know that when you look at it, yeah, I'm still doing it. You know, These papers are still there.
I like that. No, I like that a lot. Two kind of follow-ups then. The first one is like, what recommendations would you give to people then who just need like a slight course correction? So let's say, they're 1 or 2 weeks where they're slightly off, you know, they're missing their runs, they're maybe skipping their meals, they're not hitting whatever their goals are, they're not hitting their protein goals or their sleep hour goals. What would you suggest are some tangible ways people can try to course correct? And then the second bit to that is, what about someone who is very kind of far gone and they're like, actually, it's been 6 months and I am completely detached from these keystone habits that I know kind of keep me grounded?
Similar principles probably apply for both, but certainly to answer the first question, I would say that, you know, we can do a lot. We can do the basics ourselves. You know, we don't need to go and speak to the doctor, or we don't need to go and speak to a psychotherapist or a counselor all of the time. So what I would say to people is, you know, if you're starting to notice subtle changes in your sleep and your nutrition patterns, or certainly like when we talk about depression, mood disorder, for example, like depression, we look at like a 2 week period where if these changes in these, in your behavior and your mood, your thoughts persist for 2 weeks or more, and they're becoming very problematic and they're becoming much more intense, then that's like a sort of short-term window where you need to be aware of. But we can educate ourselves very well as people. You know, we can go online and we can sort of do like a self-assessment. Like, these don't give a diagnosis for sure. That's not what you do. But there's a lot of really useful tools that go online and we can educate ourselves about, you know, how is the symptoms of depression or how are the symptoms of anxiety interfering with my life? I actually didn't know this. I didn't realize that this was a characteristic or a sign of anxiety. You know, I didn't realize that. So the more you educate yourself, I would say the better. And start recording. You know, start recording in a diary and start putting things in paper in front of you or in your smartphone and start tracking it. It doesn't take very long to do that every day. You know, you can spend 2 minutes at the end of the day where you can just start to track how your mood has been today, you know, your behaviors, if you've altered it significantly in any way. In the short term, that's really important because it shows you, you know, visually if things are moving in a direction that are not good for you. And what I will say about your mental health as well, when we talk about our mental health, is that we also have to understand that we're going to have varying emotions, different type of emotions throughout the course of the day. Now, that doesn't mean that you've got poor mental health. So when I talk about mental health, I talk about our well-being, all-encompassing. So that's our emotions, our thoughts, our feelings. It's how we connect and interact with people. It's how we view ourselves in the world around us. And we can be sad 1 minute, we can be frustrated the next minute, happy the next minute, but still have good mental health, right? So we can put up with the challenges and adversity on a day-to-day basis, but still maintain good mental health. And your mental health and your well-being can really be viewed just like your physical health on a continuum, where you can move in a direction quite quickly where it's not so good, but you can also correct it quite quickly with some of these techniques that I mentioned, like recording your symptoms and your behavior and your mood to stop it and go back in a direction that it's good mental health again. So that's what I would say for the first question. But the second question, really, when you're talking like for things that have been persisting for 6 months or more, as a therapist or as somebody working in mental health, if somebody has symptoms of depression or anxiety that have been persisting for 6 months or more, they're really becoming problematic for you. So some of the things and areas that I mentioned are like sleep, changes in your diet, withdrawing from other people, losing interest in activity you normally get pleasure in, having feelings of guilt, more anxiety-related feelings, or feeling on edge all the time, or an intense worry, or when we talk about stress, it really manifests itself in the body in physical symptoms, so sweating a lot, increased heart rate, digestive problems. In men as well, we're actually starting to see things where like back pain and headaches are becoming a problem, which are signs of maybe anxiety or stress-related. If that has been persisting for 6 months or more, causing you problems being able to function on a day-to-day basis. So when I say function, it means concentrate at work like you normally used to work, complete things at ease that you would normally take for granted. Those things that start to really become impaired because of this over that period of time, I would suggest reaching out to have a consult or a chat with your doctor first of all, because it may very well be that you're not coping with stress quite well, but you know, symptoms of chronic stress or maybe other, you know, mental health conditions, they can be indicators of other serious medical conditions such as heart disease or diabetes or higher blood pressure. So if you're talking at a time scale of 6 months or more and it's becoming really problematic for you, you should reach out and have a chat with somebody. Just put you at ease.
Yeah, 100%. I'm really curious about the and what you've said there, and even just in kind of like the wider body of research of how more and more is coming out about the link between, we'll use the term well-being and good mental health with exercise, and how exercise is so fundamental to actually keeping your brain healthy as well. Could you even speak to that a wee bit?
For sure. There's many elements to it. You know, first of all, exercise, it's now in many countries worldwide, in many healthcare systems, being prescribed,
wow,
you know, as part of treatment. So in Scandinavia, it's been done for a long, long time now.
Really? I actually didn't know that. That's pretty gangster.
Yeah. Doctors will typically prescribe like a week or a physical exercise activity program for several weeks for some of their patients. And here in certainly Toronto, in the hospitals that I work with, you know, we take a very holistic approach, I would say, in what we do. We certainly don't want to provide somebody with, you know, a course of medication that they don't necessarily need because their anxiety or their symptoms are not at that severe level just yet. So we will try other forms of treatment, such as, you know, increasing your physical activity levels or, you know, talk therapy. But with regards to physical activity, it's hugely important. You know, a lot of the research and a lot of evidence shows that it induces stress levels. You know, it makes you feel better. It improves your overall well-being. And that's something that, you know, over a long period of time, if you're able to sort of build a structure and a routine of physical exercise into your week or your day, you're beating your mood to it, if you get me, you know, already actionable. You know, a lot of people talk about how they don't feel motivated to run or exercise, but, you know, if you turn that on its head, you know, the action should become before the motivation, really.
Mm.
You know, if I have a bad day and I don't feel motivated to exercise, I won't exercise. But I know if I have a structure, if I have a habit in place where I'm doing it anyway, and even the days when I feel bad or feel good, I'm doing it anyway,
mm-hmm.
I know that the exercise is going to contribute to my overall well-being. So exercise is fundamental. You know, it's hugely important part of your maintaining a good well-being. But there's other parts of it as well. When you talk about exercise, you can exercise alone, but you can also exercise in groups, mm-hmm. right? So exercise brings people together. And one thing I think that COVID has really highlighted is that human connection that we all need. You know, those bonds with people. You know, I can connect with you at the click of a button. You know, we're more connected, we think, to people across the world in an age that we've never been, but we're much more isolated as people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because, you know, the feelings of loneliness are, it's an emotional state. I could, for example, live alone, not feel lonely or socially isolated, but I could be completely, you know, part of a large group of people and still feel lonely. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people out there that feel this way. So the human connection part that you also get by physical activity and being around people, you know, even in parks, running, if it's in groups, if it's playing soccer, if it's, you know, playing rugby or Gaelic football, that interaction with people is a huge part of maintaining your well-being as a person. You know, you have a greater chance of being able to talk to somebody if you're not feeling so well. You know, it promotes self-seeking behavior because you're in a large group as well. So physical exercise is hugely important. And it's something that, you know, it's one of the sort of treatments that I always promote when I'm working with patients, especially those who would never have really thought about it.
Mm-hmm. No, it's so, so interesting. And I love that comment you made about even people prescribing it and how the answer isn't always just all of a sudden start taking medicine. You know, it's like that can be used in conjunction with all these other things as well, you know. And it's great, like, the more we learn about this sort of stuff, the more we realize that those sort of keystone habits and how important they are in each of our lives. Switching gears just slightly then, like, you used the word connection a lot there, and, you know, kind of topical, but how would you describe, like, your current connection to home at the minute? And I guess a roundabout way of getting there is, did you leave Northern Ireland on good terms? Like, what I mean, like, could you not wait to leave, or was it just an opportunity that you went for?
So I'd say there's several factors to that, really. You know, I was at a point where a number of things contributed to it. I'd say certainly, you know, career development for me was important, hugely important. And I was sort of working in and out of contracts at that point in time, and I was doing okay, but I wasn't working really, I don't think, in the area where I trained in, you know, specifically psychology directly and a good work. And, you know, I did look at, you know, other parts, like going to England or Scotland, for example, to work there. But again, like I said, there's huge sort of wait lists and a lot of sort of barriers really in the way. And one of the motivating factors really was, you know, like, I was young as well, you know, I don't want to miss this opportunity where potentially I look back and think, I could have went, you know, but I didn't. So that plays into your sort of motivation as well in terms of looking abroad. And yeah, for several months before I moved, you know, I was definitely having conversations with my immediate family about my thoughts, about what I was going to do. It moved quite quickly, you know, within booking the flight, within a month I was here in Toronto. But I didn't really hang about. I'd say another important factor as well was that, you know, I picked up a lot of injuries playing sports and a lot of, you know, over time doing that, I had surgery and I stepped away for about 9 months at one time to recover. And then that really sort of opens up in your mindset and gives you a broader perspective about, you know, well, it's not all about just focusing on maybe the sport and the GA. Well, you know, post that, what are you going to do with yourself, Michal? You know, there's other things that you need to start maybe thinking about now. And then myself and Leah, we've been together since, teenagers in Uri. She went to school there and I went to school there as well, and that's where we met, and we've been there ever since, been together ever since. So Leah is also a Canadian citizen. Her parents lived in Canada, and I applied for a visa. It's called the IEC visa, which gives you 2 year. It's a really amazing program, International Experience Canada, where you can go to Canada for a 2 year period. You can work and travel as much as you like for 2 years.
And wow. Want.
But within those sort of 2 years, you can build up enough sort of time to support your application to become a permanent resident. And that's what turned out for me. So when we moved here, Leah's parents lived in Toronto, they lived in Edmonton, they lived, you know, all over Canada. But if you're going to move anywhere, it was to move abroad. If you're going to move abroad, you obviously look at, like, the United States, you look at Australia. Canada was the most sensible option for us. And that sort of motivated the both of us to come here. And we've been, you know, Canada's been very good to us. Toronto's been very good to us since we arrived here.
It's great. And what is the kind of the Irish community like over there?
It's great. It's amazing. You know, anywhere you go in the world, you know, this Irish are going to be there somewhere. And quite quickly, even before I came here, I was connected to a cousin of mine, my mother's cousin, Dr. Jacinta O'Hanlon. She's actually a psychiatrist out here. I've been living out here for quite a long period of time. And so when she started connecting me via email, then I really got a lot more optimism about sort of options that might be within mental health in Canada. When I came here, she was really good to me. I have a really good friend out here, Colin McGuinness. I moved in with Colin for a week or two to establish my feet. He was really supportive. And then I connected with the GAA community and started to play some football for a couple of years.
Nice.
And again, it's that connection part. You know, only when you start to connect with people does your sort of your outlook and your options really start to open up. You know, if you came here alone, it's going to be much harder. Yep. They didn't build those connections and those groups. So the GAA community exists. You've arts, you've culture, you've music, where the Irish are heavily involved in. Also, you've got the, you know, your bars and restaurants and things where you can go and interact with people.
Naturally.
Of course. So the Irish community exists. We don't have, you know, a specific spot or location where all the Irish live. We're spread throughout the sort of greater Toronto area and across Canada. It's not like you have Little Italy or Little Portugal or any time.
Little Ireland, yeah.
Yeah, it's really our culture and our sort of upbringing and our background and sort of, you know, that Irishness. You bring it all together, we meet in groups that way. And that's when I really got connected.
So good, man. And how do you think about Northern Ireland now? Like, from your perspective, have you seen a change over the years? Like, how has being away from home changed your perspective of home, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at?
Yeah. It's a good question, actually. You know, you always have, I don't think anybody who moves abroad doesn't have one eye back home about what goes on all the time. So, you know, I think, you know, you keep an eye on the news, BBC News, Northern Ireland News and stuff like that. Social media is great for keeping an eye on things. And it's really amazing from a healthcare perspective to see, certainly from my end, that, you know, even here in Canada, they've learned from Northern Ireland and how to deliver mental health, believe it or not. So that's one thing when I look back and I think, wow, you know, we have some really good sort of programs and things that have been developed within healthcare in Northern Ireland over the past decade or past couple of decades that other countries are now looking towards to model. So
wow.
There are concerns definitely within mental health, specifically in Northern Ireland. You know, it's the highest rates of mental illness in the UK. Suicide rates in Northern Ireland are among the highest in the world globally. And, you know, I pay attention to a lot of people who work in that area, like Professor Siobhan O'Neill. She does a lot of amazing work. So I think we're sort of coming forward and moving on about how we sort of look at it and address it and provide opportunities to support people, because, you know, we also had the troubles in Northern Ireland as well. And there's a lot of people who have, you know, fell sort of, you know, develop problems because of that, mental health problems, physical problems, and that's generational too. You know?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people struggle with that for a long period of time. But, you know, when you're here, you hear a lot of people talking about Northern Ireland, you hear a lot of people talking about Ireland and how to want to visit it. And that also makes you think about, wow, like, you know, there's a lot there as well that maybe when you took for granted when you lived there that you didn't explore it or you didn't see enough of it. You know, it really was great to see how they responded to the COVID pandemic, you know, with jealous eyes. I was looking back at how well they rolled out the vaccine and how society started to open up a lot more, a lot quicker. So, yeah, I think when you move here and you reflect and look back towards Northern Ireland and how far it's coming on, it's developed quite a lot.
Mm. So good, man. Couple of questions we always end the show with then. These are our big hitters we always save for the end. It's like, you know, now we've like warmed you up and hopefully established some sort of sense of, okay, I can talk to this person.
This is the cool down.
yeah, this is it. So most challenging moment so far and how were you able to overcome it?
Moving abroad isn't easy. That's what I will say. You know, speaking from an immigrant perspective, Leigh and I moved here and we work very hard when you work here. But what you leave behind is your friends and family and that sort of a connection with people where you can fall back on for smallest of things that mean so important to you. Like if it's just a chat with somebody or, you know, to, you know, have a cup of tea with somebody, those type of things, you sort of, or a cup of coffee and a nice meal that your mother might have prepared for you, those type of things. You move abroad, you really have to adjust and be more independent as a person. That was a real challenge. And I can't put a time frame on that. I would say that, you know, for a number of years, certainly finding somewhere to settle and work, you know, having that sort of stability, when that really started to happen, then you really did start to appreciate how hard some of those challenges were. So I'd say that sort of immigration process was certainly one of the hardest things that I went through. Yeah.
And that's so insightful because you obviously came at it from a native speaking, highly educated viewpoint, which is bonkers if you then try to put yourself in the shoes of some of the other people that are coming into somewhere like Canada, you know?
Yeah, I can talk. Like, I can talk to this because of lived experience. I've been through the process, you know. It can be done, though. It definitely can be done. You know, a bit of hard work and a bit of sort of grafting. You push through sort of the early periods. There are times when you feel lonely and you have a lot of emotions, and those sort of emotional drawstrings will want to bring you back home sooner rather than later. But
totally,
you know, seeing it out for a period of time, you start to assimilate with your new location, i.e. Toronto, and you start to blend into the city and you start to interact with more people, just outside, maybe, you know, who are Irish, who aren't just Irish. You know, I have a lot of friends here from South America or from Asia. Those are the type of things that really help you appreciate why you made the move abroad as well.
Totally, man. Flip side of that coin then, what about your most successful moment or most proudest moment?
There's a pause here because I tend not to sort of really, you know, when I stop still really and start to reflect and do that, I find that might have a sort of negative impact on me and my motivation as a person, Matthew. I certainly think, you know, from a employment perspective was where I've got to sort of now so far, and fingers crossed I can keep stability with that and keep progressing and advancing in my sort of career, is really working, you know, in the community here in Toronto with some of our most marginalized people, people who really need that support, and seeing healthcare improvements within them, you get a lot of reward from that. I see that certainly, you know, from my end, and that's a motivating factor. They aren't as easy to come by these days, that's for sure. But that drives me from an education, from a career perspective as well. I certainly think, you know, being able to sort of, like I said, the challenge, but at the same time, being able to create stability for myself here in Toronto to a certain extent is quite rewarding. Build connections, build friends, allow Leah to sort of as well develop her career as well here. You know, it's hugely important for both of us that she was able to do that too. Looking back further, you know, there's a lot of achievements as well within sport, within my family, you know, that are milestones that I look back upon as well.
Awesome, man. If you could take anyone from Northern Ireland out for a cup of coffee, who would you take? Where would you take them and why?
I think I'd take my parents. My father hasn't been here.
Wow.
My mother has been here. She's been here once. But I certainly think I would really appreciate having my father here.
That'd be awesome. And if you could give some advice to an 18-year-old version of yourself, what would it be?
Look further, you know, look, broaden your horizon. You know, I say look further, you know, maybe look outside of what you're doing right now, because there's a lot more out there in the world as well. I'm not encouraging people that have to travel abroad to do that, but broaden your perspective in the world that you live in. You can see things a lot differently as well. I'd say for young people, really keep connected with friends, peers, male peers, female peers, work colleagues. Don't allow yourself to get disconnected from people. Don't allow things like social media, like Twitter and Instagram, to overwhelm you and dictate your mood. Really appreciate the things that you can control, you know, in your life, I think, as well. And embrace those much more.
I love that, man. Final question for you then. And this is the long pause. This is the one that always... What is the kindest thing that someone's ever done for you?
I'm not going to individualize anybody, that's for sure. I really don't think that's fair on anybody. But what I will say is, you know, I think my parents, my brothers, they've given me this sort of opportunity to grow up around them. Being with Leah, she's shown me so much about, you know, other things that are happening in the world as well. She really encourages me in a lot of ways to keep pushing forward and moving in a direction with my career and developing as a person. I appreciate the opportunities that managers and people in healthcare here, and, you know, people within the Irish community have done for me here as well when I moved to Toronto. So there's so many nice gestures. I mentioned Dr. Jacinta O'Hanlon and my friend Colin McGuinness and people like that, that, you know, you don't appreciate how important they are to you at the time, and maybe you don't express that to them enough, but only for that generosity, then you wouldn't have the opportunity. I actually wouldn't have had the opportunity to be where I am here now.
As you said earlier, it's the small stuff sometimes, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, it definitely is.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Well, look, thank you very much for listening over the last hour or so. I really hope you enjoyed this time with me, Hall. If you'd like to check out other episodes in this series, you can head to niconnections.com. And other than that, me, Hall, just would love to say thank you so much for not only your time, but also just everything that you shared today as well. It was awesome.
Matthew, thanks. I really, really enjoyed it. Thoroughly enjoyed the opportunity. Thank you.